Last time we were together, we looked at Joseph facing a new challenge. It doesn't look like a challenge. I mean, here he is, Grand Vizier of all of Egypt. He has a wife from a powerful family and two sons to carry on his name. He has even learned that his father and his blood brother are alive and well. People bow to him. His own brothers have bowed to him just as his dream foretold. And yet that very act ignited within him anger at all those old wounds. He turns harshly on them. Subconsciously, at least, he reacts by wanting to punish these brothers. His new challenge is internal. He needs to overcome the desire to exact retribution. Retribution. It's one of the hard words. And I'm supposed to say them twice if they're on the bingo. He needs to learn to master his internal craving for retaliation. He's still wrestling with that old pain, but he sends them on his way. They've been generously gifted with the food they sought, but it has come at a great cost. The second eldest, Simeon, has been held as a pledge that they are indeed the honest men they claim to be. Why Simeon? Someone asked me. I think it was probably because Reuben has lost his position as firstborn. He willingly shamed his father by sleeping with his mother's handmaiden, breaking a custom that existed far before the giving of the law. And he'd been ineffective at protecting Joseph in his role as eldest. Joseph may also have felt something. Though he was ineffective, Reuben had stood up for him and was not directly involved in his sale into slavery. So he may have chosen to spare him the indignity of prison. Simeon then, as next in line, is chosen as the bond against the return of these men. Even worse, the only bail that will free him is the appearance before the vizier of Jacob's last son and all that remains to him of his beloved wife, Rachel. That will mean taking Benjamin from Jacob at the risk of never seeing him alive again. They slowly trudge back, afraid to tell their father the situation, only to discover that all their money has been returned to them. Circumstantially, they look like thieves in addition to Joseph's charge of espionage. And the last chapter ended with Jacob despondent over a situation he sees as hopeless. All he can do to protect himself and the family is to cut his losses. Joseph and Simeon are gone to him, but Benjamin must be protected at all cost. Otherwise, Jacob laments that he would go down to his grave in sorrow. And this new chapter that we're looking at today, chapter 43, it opens with a reminder of just how severe the famine was. So severe that the grain they had obtained from Egypt was now gone. Their father commanded the sons to go to Egypt to buy more food. A little food, he says. Yet there are still 5 more years of famine. Jacob doesn't know what Joseph does. In his mind, a little food might get them through. The same man who had paid for the previous grain with another son's imprisonment and separation is now urging them to go again. Desperate times evoke desperate measures. And Judah responds. He uncovers the elephant in the room. The man told us we would not see his face again unless Benjamin was brought before him. Judah's making the demands now. If you send our brother, we will go. But if not, we won't. And again, he reminds of the great man's promise. Only with the youngest son in the entourage would these men be cleared of the charges. We see a real shift in the narrative here at this point. While they had food, they could ignore the issues raised by this powerful man in Egypt. But now they're confronted by their reality. For the first time in the story, the father is named Israel. That name has various meanings. Commonly, we're told it means he who wrestles with God. Now he wrestles with the situation he finds himself in. He laments that his sons have brought this upon him. But we know that it's his own poor parenting that has resulted in this loss of two sons. I see him wringing his hands in a losing situation. Send Benjamin and risk loss of all he has left of Rachel, or do nothing and starve. And the boys are quick to defend themselves. He kept interrogating and badgering us. How are we supposed to know? He'd demand our youngest brother. And Judah steps up again. Send the boy. Hardly a boy. He's at least 25 years old in most scholars' opinions. Send him so that we will not die. Not just you, Father, but us and our children. I will guarantee his return to you. I will bear the guilt forever if he does not come back. The mantle of leadership is moving from Jacob to the next generation. Bypassing Reuben and Simeon, it is Judah that it finds itself settling upon. Note the difference in this offer to the one that Reuben made. Reuben offered his sons' lives, but here Judah offers his own life. It foreshadows the lion of the tribe of Judah that will also offer his life to ransom back others. It foreshadows the lives of Christians that are to offer their lives as a sacrifice of service to God. It recognizes the brokenness both in the situation they're in and in their family life as the beginning of healing. In the future, Judah's very presence in front of Israel would be a reminder of his failure to fulfill his pledge should he not bring Benjamin back. Judah offers to live with this failure in his father's house, never receiving forgiveness nor love. In that sense, it has a far more negative outcome than we have as Christians when we fail, because John tells us that we have an advocate who lives to intercede on our behalf. And compared to Reuben's offer, this is much more personal and costly. As precious as the lives of Reuben's two sons were, they were an exchange for the two lost sons of Israel. Judah is offering to himself become like a lost one, though he's still present in body. Isn't that exactly what Jesus did? Becoming a lost one for a time that we might be found and returned to God? Apparently, what would happen to this family had been a topic of conversation for a long time as the grain stores dwindled. We could have been there and back at least twice if we'd not dallied. Must have pushed Israel over the edge, weighing one great trouble over another. The present situation of the lost sons being compounded, or the future imperative of starvation. Finally, he's resigned. It's the lesser of two evils to send Benjamin, as he cannot see his whole family perish. It was more than 200 kilometers. Even at the fastest pace, it was more than a week's travel. But if you look at it from another point of view, if donkeys can carry about 100 pounds, and that's a well-established fact, and if it's assumed an adult would eat about 30 pounds of grain per year, and that's figures generally accepted by science, we can estimate how long it would have been since they had gone to Egypt previously. They'd brought back about 30 person years of grain. Later, 66 were said to go down to Egypt as the household, so even at full rations, it's reasonable to think they'd brought back a half a year's worth of grain. With children in the numbers and rationing, perhaps more. So it seems they'd indeed been talking about this for a long time and talking seriously only once it became dire. He offers to send things back. Perhaps you wondered, as I did, where did he get these medicines and food to offer as a gift? But notice they're all items that can be stored. They are long-term preserved items. This was the depth of his concern for Benjamin, that Jacob would offer these treasures held against the drought in an effort to secure his safe return. Take double the money, he says, in case it was a mistake, and may God Almighty, El Shaddai, show you mercy in front of this man. This description of this name for God has not been used since Abraham's time, and it reflects Israel's renewed need to trust that God would be compassionate and soften the Egyptian's heart and return Benjamin and allow Simeon to go free. If not, Israel says, then I must live with this loss. And so they go to Egypt a second time, carrying a double payment, literally in their hands, as if it is an offering to the great man rather than just payment for goods. They arrive in Egypt. Once again, Joseph recognizes them, but he's not recognized by them. He spots Benjamin among them and orders that they should be sent to his home. The men are once again in fear. They don't know what we do, that it's a dinner invitation. They judge they're being detained because of the missing silver. The man's servant seems far more approachable, so they plead their case with him. Sir, we had honorable intentions, but when we opened our sacks, our money was back with the grain. We brought it back, here it is, to demonstrate our integrity. And the steward's response is remarkable. He says, peace, shalom, don't be afraid. He explains it away as a gift from God. He seems to have a better view of God's care for them than they do. As for me, your debt was paid. Simeon is returned to them. The man sees to it that their feet are washed. That's the action of a host, not a jailer. He feeds their donkeys. And how their attitude must have been refreshed by that. From fear to wonder at this treatment as honored guests. So they set out the gifts from their father. And when the great man came, he accepted their gifts. They bowed in thankfulness before him, and he spoke to them kindly. No more accusations and interrogation. Now he asks about their father's well-being. Joseph casts his gaze on Benjamin, his full-blood brother, and asks, is this the one you had told me about? Then he blesses him. He calls upon God to be gracious to Benjamin. This particular construction has only been used three other times in Genesis, though it's fairly common in the Old Testament, especially in the Psalms. And interestingly, the other three times were twice by Esau, when Jacob came in fear back to his homeland many years before, and Esau had sworn to kill him, but Esau had been ready to forgive. And the brothers had used that same word in a different sense, when they remembered that Joseph had looked for compassion to them and pleaded for his life, as we looked at last time. Unlike then, when Joseph was a nuisance to get rid of, now they too have had a change of heart and realized their sin, just as Esau. This blessing signals a change in relationship. Joseph is coming nearer to be able to fully forgive. He's been wrestling with this situation himself and with the idea of vengeance. His long years in Egypt have made him forget, and he was numb to the pain. But the first arrival of the brothers brought all that flooding back. As we talked about last time, he's been suppressing it. He probably had no idea that it was still lingering prior to their arrival and simmering, waiting for it to be brought back to the surface. He hadn't contained it. He'd acted out against them in a game that was leading to retaliation. But just as the other brothers had initiated that kind of feeling on the last trip, now the sight of Benjamin elicits forgiveness. He's so moved that once again he must leave them and hurry out. The last time he turned away to regain his composure. He'd overheard and understood their recognition of that time when he had pleaded for compassion, and his heart was softened just a little. But once more he'd become the hard man that held their fate and sent them away, never to return unless they had Benjamin. This time it's even more touching. He needed to go to another room. He needed to wash in order to gain control of his emotions. Once more he will be moved to tears, but that will be still more emotional. Their father's request of El Shaddai had been met. Compassion was awakening in Joseph. He feasted with these men. He was separated from them, yes, and separated from the Egyptians, but he feasted lavishly. Benjamin receives five times what the others received. How they must have wondered why this was happening. It says the brothers actually became drunk. They drank so much. And yet, with all of this, Joseph still has to see yet more proof that these men had changed, that they would look out for the outcast, the young and the foolish one, just as he had been so many years ago. Jacob had been a poor father. As a result, he had been undermined and defied, disrespected, and brought to grief through a lie. As a result, Joseph had been ridiculed, tortured, and abandoned to slavery. Joseph needed to learn. He needed to know that these brothers had learned their lesson, and Benjamin and his father would now be respected and loved. His test was both clever and potent. He would face them with a choice: protect themselves, watch out for their own backsides, or protect Benjamin. We've seen something in Judah that points forward to the gift of Jesus. Judah's ready to exchange his own life for the life of Benjamin. We're going to look at that next time. We'll reach the climax of this whole story next time, in which Joseph breaks down and reveals himself to the brothers, in which he will point to God's providence for in caring for this family. We can see in Jesus' gift of his life the power for us to overcome retaliation, because Jesus' atoning blood covers sin. We're still weighed down by these sins if we hang on to them. Retaliation is an inevitable consequence. The only way to overcome is if we let our Lord take them away. Peter reminds us, above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. And I don't think it's just our love he's talking about here. It's important that our love is foremost in our lives, but our love has meaning only when we recognize that it's God's love in sending his Son and Jesus' love in offering himself in our place, as Judah did for Benjamin. Only when that happens can God forget and drop, as we discussed last time in class, our sin. Accept Jesus' gift and give your desire for retribution over to God. When God lets go of our sin, it is truly gone forever, and we are able to live as he always intended, as his beloved children.